You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Israel's Prime Minister Ariel Sharon was welcomed in the White House this week, and many in Washington, D.C. protested his attendance there. Reem Kadhuta from Pacifica Station WPFW has more in this report.
Holding a sign that reads, "End the occupation and the violence. Sharon is an obstacle to peace. Human rights are universal." The American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee is holding a vigil on the corner of K and 17th Street in Farragut Park in Washington, D.C.
USA talks about how bad Saddam Hussein is. With his record, Ariel Sharon is just as bad, if not worse, than Saddam. He's killed thousands of Palestinian and Lebanese civilians in Lebanon. He's done massacres in the refugee camps of Sabra and Shatila. He became Prime Minister of Israel, and he's accepted in here with a red carpet. We still believe that that's not right.
Israel has not complied with any of the UN resolutions that have been passed in order to stop what's going on in Palestine. The U.S. has not attempted to go after Israel, but with Iraq, when Saddam just doesn't go through with one resolution, the whole world is against him. And I think it's a complete double standard just because he's Arab and is a leader of a major Arab country, which controls a lot of oil wealth.
There are plenty of countries with rulers who are dictators who the U.S. backs to the hilt. I think of countries like the Pinochet regime in Chile and Indonesia under Suharto. The U.S. doesn't export democracy. The U.S. exports empire. The U.S. exports the U.S. brand, that the red, white, and blue, the stars and stripes. That's almost a corporate logo at this point. And what they want is that brand stamped on as many parts of the globe as they possibly can, so that they can have as much military and economic control of the world as possible, stomping out anybody who makes any attempt to match them militarily or economically. So that's why I'm out here.
We need to do everything we can over here to try to educate others about what's going on. And when enough people are educated, perhaps then our government will be unable to proceed with its foreign policy that's destructive. It's destructive to the people that it directly impacts, and it's destructive to us Americans, who many people all over the world right now look at us as very hypocritical. We go around preaching democracy and claiming to uphold human rights for all people, and yet we are paying for the systematic violation of Palestinian human rights by the Israeli military and Israeli army. Israel's in violations of dozens of human rights, and we continue to turn a blind eye and pay for it while going on record and making speeches and our rhetoric that we believe in human rights and that we must enforce human rights all over the world.
Protesters across the country are keeping the heat on politicians, as we hear in this report from Dave Littman.
Chapel Hill, North Carolina is a small college town. Raleigh is a capital that has been described as a suburb of nothing. Between them lie Durham, Park, and a mushrooming array of suburbs and subdevelopments. Politically and culturally, this area, known as the Triangle, cannot seem to decide whether it's a metropolitan area or a set of small southern towns. Either way, it is widely acknowledged as an island of dissent in a conservative state. Since September 11th, a constellation of old and new peace organizations here has worked aggressively to build a movement for alternatives to the war drive in Washington. An important new force has been the campaign to end the cycle of violence, embracing both campus and community activists. Its initial goal was to reopen the space for dissent that was clamped shut in the aftermath of the jetliner attacks. This was done through campus speakouts at which counter-demonstrators were encouraged to take the microphone and dialogue, as well as a series of larger teach-ins promoted together with the Progressive Faculty Network. Working with the North Carolinians for Alternatives to War, Peace First, Peace Action, and others, CECV activists brought anti-war sentiment to the streets. Theatrical touches such as a comedic Jeopardy skit and a frighteningly realistic Palestinian checkpoint simulation kept the public educated and entertained. One-day fasts at the offices of Senator Edwards challenged participants to increase their commitment. With the latest stage of oil adventures disguised as preemptive war, activists have ramped up their public presence. There had been frustration that actions at downtown sites reached only small numbers of people. A decision was made to go to where Americans live, in their cars. The office of Congressman David Price sits on a busy highway. On Monday, October 7th, 325 people appeared alongside the highway with banners exhorting motorists to honk to stop the war. Response was overwhelming. Semi-trucks joined with subcompacts and even SUVs in a din of opposition to Bush's unilateral war drive. Meanwhile, a dozen constituents occupied the congressman's office, demanding to talk with him by speakerphone to Washington. They were told he couldn't be reached.
Yes, he can be reached if he wants to reach his constituents. If he doesn't, they're going to sit there until he does.
Price was eventually brought to the phone. He declined to commit to opposing all moves to war and described an alternate resolution he was promoting.
Representative Price,
that's what I'm doing.
Would you support the alternative resolution proposed by Barbara Lee, which calls for...
I don't even know the full range of alternative resolutions. I'm telling you what I'm working on. You may agree with this or you may not, but it does permit the protection of inspectors.
Local concerns also played a part in the anxiety of some participants. Leslie McDougall.
I don't understand how Representative Price can even consider opening up his constituents to that kind of peril. Many of us in the 4th District live almost on top of a nuclear power plant. I have not been assured that this is a safe place for me to be in case of a terrorist attack.
Protesters stayed in the office for 24 hours before being evicted by police. The following week, worried that Chapel Hill might have become as marginalized as Berkeley in the mind of the national press, protesters moved the Honk Fest to Raleigh, where 200 protesters incited the rolling Citizens Assembly to take their first action for peace by putting their hands to the horn. Again, the response was surprisingly positive. Michal Osterweil, a graduate student and member of Campaign to End the Cycle of Violence.
Everyone I talk to is against this war, or at least is just really shocked. It was remarkable because we hadn't done anything at all semester that was large scale. And then we had the Iraq teach-in where there was standing room only and it was full. And I think from that moment on, there was a sense that people were just needing to express themselves and do something, and that there was a lot more opposition than we had even recognized, and that this opposition needed to just be channeled.
And the move to Raleigh brought new forces onto the line, from members of the Arab community to people who drove hundreds of miles from the coast to join the protest. Deborah Lee Axe of Holly Ridge, near Camp Lejeune.
The money that we are spending on war could end poverty around the earth, on the whole earth. It could end poverty, a fraction of what we're spending on war. This is insanity.
Although a culture of youth protest clearly has not approached Vietnam-era levels, it is growing. High school student Jake Stockwell on what moved him to the streets.
A feeling that you're doing the right thing. A feeling that that you're not just sitting at home and saying you're against it. You're actually influencing others to support you and support the movement.
The people that I've sat down and talked with are against war and the whole idea of it, because it doesn't really get you anywhere. It just creates more enemies.
Organizers are conscious that, as energizing as the interplay in traffic is, it can wear down the participants if it does not draw in new people and move to new tactics. Horn honking may be the quintessential American expression, but it builds only limited dialogue with activists. Michal Osterweil.
In creating a movement and creating these spaces, we have really phenomenal opportunities to politicize people that are just sort of like reacting to this on a visceral level and have never even thought about this, or are generally conservative and would support the war on terror. And I think that those conversations have the potential to create alliances, or at least move people towards a more critical position, even with the war on terrorism at large.
Activists are looking for ways to get citizens out of their cars and onto the line. They're also looking toward coordinated statewide actions targeting government offices and other sites connected with war and the war economy.
That's actually part of what is sort of not scaring me, but keeping me up at nights. I do think that there needs to be something more disruptive that takes place, in the sense of like actually making people think about what war, the death of millions of people, means.
Organizers are working as well to ally with church communities. A recent press conference in Raleigh brought 100 clergy together in an anti-war statement. The movement needs to move from the highways to other avenues. The great unreached masses are out there. Peace Action member Ruth Zalf.
There's still a lot of people who are hovering between what's the right thing to do, where do I stand. This is what movements are made of. Thousands become tens of thousands, become hundreds of thousands, become the millions.
Where do they go from here? Last week, students leafleted at the Carolina versus State football game, handing out flyers describing the similarities and differences between war and football. Next week, there will be a peace booth at the state fair and another honk fest at the mall. And activists are looking at the campaign appearances of senatorial candidates for possible interventions.
We live in a country right now where there's choice A and choice A. Like, there's no difference between, and those people, I think, are, like, looking to us as, like, in hope that maybe this means that there's potential for a real political change.
This is Dave Lippman in the Triangle, North Carolina.
Presidential economic advisor Lawrence Lindsay is estimating a war in Iraq will cost $100 billion. Other economists think the immediate cost could be much higher, and that a war on Iraq could have unknown long-term economic effects. At a teach-in last weekend in Boston, Robert Borsage from the Campaign for America's Future gave this analysis of the economic consequences of war.
Obviously, economic consequences in some level are a second-order concern. They're not as valuable as the bodies that will be lost, the lives that will be squelched, the environmental destruction that will poison children across the region. All of those things, in many ways, are much more important. And in making the decision to go to war or to oppose the war, I think most everyone here would oppose this war even if it were free. And I think the holy warriors around Rumsfeld would wage the war even if it would bankrupt America. And so in some ways, the economic argument is not a dispositive argument. It doesn't tell you to go or no, not go. But it is important to understand what we are doing when we set ourselves up for this kind of an operation. Whatever the short-term costs of the war in Iraq, they are really nothing compared to the long-term consequences of how we spend our scarce resources in the public sector, the resources of public funds and public attention, when we entertain the kind of preemptive global doctrine that the Bush administration has put forth. The Bible says, where your treasure is, so there is your heart. I can tell you where this country's treasure is. The U.S. military budget, homeland security, and international affairs of next year will be at about $440 billion. That is an increase of $47 billion from last year. That increase is greater than any other single military budget in the world, the increase alone. In fact, the United States next year will spend more on buying, developing new weapons than any other country will spend on its entire military. That expenditure, $447 billion, is about 55% of the discretionary budget at the federal level. That is, all the funds for everything the government does, other than interest on the national debt, which it has no choice about, and the entitlements, Social Security and Medicare, which are separately funded. So 55% of what the Congress actually votes about will go to Homeland Security and the military. At the same time, our budget has gone from surplus, as you know, to deficit. This is, incidentally, the first war in our history where a president declares war and says to the wealthy, you can pay less in taxes rather than more in taxes. And the result is the White House is putting enormous pressure on domestic spending in all areas outside of the military and homeland defense. There are cuts of 4% in real terms slated for the budget this year. And that means serious cuts. Worker training, at a time when unemployment is up and workers need to be retrained, will be down 11%. Energy conservation, at a time when one would think we would be pressing for energy efficiency, is down 17%. Pollution control, down 7%. Water resources, the clean water you drink, the sewers that carry it, down 7%. Transport, down 6%. Community development, block grants, mostly child care money, at a time when 11 million children under the age of 13 go home alone after school, is down 22%. College funding, for those of you who have students in college, down 3%. Lawrence Lindsay's $100 billion, the easy money to raise for the war, that alone could pay for the following: health care for all the uninsured children this year, and repair of 10% of the schools in the country that need repair, and double what we spend on the environment, and five times what we spend on the global AIDS agenda, and after-school care to 7 million children, and pay for 60,000 new teachers, and a doubling of the international assistance budget, and assistance to the states in staving off Medicaid cuts. That $100 billion alone. But the larger distortion is what we become when we set down this road. When you commit over half of your discretionary spending to the military, you tend to see the world through the military lens. We'll also accustom ourselves to seeking out monsters abroad to destroy rather than dealing with our own economy. Let me give you some examples right now. Consider the energy policy. We will spend $30 billion a year, every year, to sustain a position in the Persian Gulf and keep oil cheap. But we're not spending anything in the president's energy policy that would actually increase energy efficiency in any significant degree and make us independent with renewables and energy efficient from Persian Gulf oil. There's a lot of talk in this society in education. Here's the education crisis of this country. We have the largest wave of students going into the public schools since the baby boom. They are going into schools that are already overcrowded and are in the worst disrepair in our history, with an average age of over 40 years for schools. And they do so as we face the largest wave of teacher retirements ever. And yet, we pay beginning teachers among the lowest of any occupation that requires a bachelor's degree. Now, it is inescapable that you have to spend a hell of a lot more money at every level of government if we are going to meet this crisis. It cannot be done with reorganization. It cannot be done by pretending we're going to give vouchers to kids. You have to invest in public education to be able to meet this massive challenge. And the level of the president's budget for next year, the increase for next year on education, is exactly nada, zero. At the federal level. Yet, for simply the increase in spending since 9/11 on the Pentagon and Homeland Security, not counting Lawrence Lindsay's $100 billion for the war on Iraq, we could come close to tripling the entire federal education budget. With that money over 5 years, you could repair every school, hire many of the teachers needed, and provide after-school care for all. So we pursue the course we're on. We will have smarter missiles. But we are likely not to have smarter children.
Robert Borisage from the Campaign for America's Future. Thanks to Martin Volker of No U-Turn Radio for technical assistance with that segment. David Rovix is one of the most well-known political folk singers in America today. He has become something of a fixture in the North American protest scene, performing at demonstrations across the continent. We thought it would be interesting to hear some of his perspectives as we lead up to the war, as he expresses it through his political music.
A safer country, and it's in God we trust. So we'll bomb you during Ramadan, turn your world into dust. But pull up on your bootstraps, stand on your own 2 feet, as we blow them off with cluster bombs disguised as something to eat. We stand for freedom and prosperity, so we'll bomb your schools and hospitals. Make sure you live in misery, and all you evildoers, and your children and your wives. With our B-52s, we'll show you how we value civilian lives. Give us your hungry, your restless. We'll show you democracy, a military trial, and detention indefinitely. We'll have homeland security. Thomas Ridge, all hail. We may not find the terrorists, but we can throw the left in jail, and we will all be safe, and we shall have no fears. Once our retinas have been scanned, and all the walls have ears, and we're all in good hands.
David Rovix, what's a nice folk singer like you doing writing such radical songs like The Flag, Desecration Rag, Bomb Ourselves, Good Kurds, Bad Kurds, and Drink of the Death Squads? Whatever happened to the nice folk songs about special loves and love of life and the love of country, for God's sakes?
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, it's really the folk tradition has been, people have been writing about this stuff for a long time. It's really, I mean, I think it's more the question of, you know, what happened to folk music when the music industry came along and started, you know, telling people that the only thing they wanted to, you know, record or sell records of was stuff about relationships. And that's always been a popular subject for songs, but stuff happening in the world has always been a popular subject.
Mm-hmm.
For sure.
What inspires your songs?
Well, Bush has been my greatest inspiration, really, I'd have to say. He's been wildly inspiring. I mean, the contradictions of the people running our world into the ground. I think that generally the most inspiring thing for me lately has been his speeches. And, he says something like, you know, we're going to hunt down countries that are harboring terrorists. Meanwhile, you know, here we have the School of the Americas in Georgia and the, you know, terrorists in Miami and terrorists all over the country. And, these kinds of contradictions are good fodder for songs. And I guess I'm inspired by people's struggles around the world, here in this country and around the world, and inspired in a sort of macabre way by, you know, villages getting destroyed by bombs and stuff like that. I mean, it's every one of those situations is worthy of a song. Every one of those people struggling, every one of those people being killed, you know, they're all worthy of songs. And I can't write possibly nearly enough of them.
Mm. I read on your CD package a statement you wrote that says, don't let anyone tell you there's something wrong with you if you find yourself sobbing for the empathy you feel for the malnourished, dying children of Basra. The Bush administration says the people of Iraqi, or the people of Iraq, are our friends, and that's part of his justification for wanting to attack Iraq and rid them of the president, Saddam Hussein. How is that playing in Gainesville, Florida, where you are?
Well, I mean, I guess I tend to play for activist audiences, and when I have the opportunity to sing for people who aren't in the activist scene, which I always relish, people are usually really sympathetic and really interested and really concerned about what our government is doing, and I think to a large extent, the Bush is able to play on people's fears and those fears of, you know, terrorism and other fears that people have, weapons of mass destruction, all that. You know, he's, you know, being able to nail some good ones that people are afraid of those things. But people are, I think a lot of people are confused and a lot of people are really just upset about what the government is doing and Bush's unending war. And they don't want anything of it, but I think a lot of people feel powerless. They feel like they're not being heard, and they're certainly not on NPR. You know, they're being heard on Pacifica, but, you know. Yeah.
Have you written any songs for President Bush lately?
Let's see. Hang a Flag in the Window I wrote last spring, and Bomb Ourselves, and, I mean, specifically for the Bush administration, you know, I guess the last one that was really inspired by a speech by GW was Bomb Ourselves. In Hang a Flag in the Window, actually, I do address the axis of evil in the third verse. But yeah, that would be a fine. I mean, turning the stuff on its head, I think is a really a powerful way to do things, like the kinds of articles that The Onion does all the time. You know, know, it's just, there's just, I mean, you can make satire out of this. You can make serious songs out of this, but the contradictions need to be exposed. And I think when you do expose the contradictions, especially if you do it in some kind of way that appeals to people on an emotional level, whether it's, whether because it's funny or because you're really without using catchphrases, just talking about what happened or some situation and so that people can relate to it on an emotional level. People do relate to it.
If I could sing a song for every bomb that flies, I'd sing each and all the days. If there were to be a verse.
You've been listening to Imperatives for Peace, Pacifica's Peace Watch. Our producer is Scott Gurian. Tonight's engineer was Granger Helvey. Our associate producers are Fidel Rodriguez of KPFK, Renee Feltz of KPFT, and Robert Knight of WBAI. Sam Husseini and Larry Bensky are consultants to the program. We had production assistance from Laurel Paget-Seekins at WPFW. Our webmaster is Pete Caracas. For copies of Peace Watch, go to www.pacificaarchives.org or call 1-800-735-0230. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Thank you for listening.
Somewhere in America. But I'll sing a song for Basra. If I could shed a tear for every home that bombs destroy, I'd never stop crying. If each broken brick were a heart of a little girl or boy, all the world's children would be sighing. If I could hold each shattered body, each baby stilled at birth, I'd have no time for loneliness. I'd spend all my days embracing the people of this savaged earth, feeling the poisoned wind's caress. And the billionaires are laughing somewhere in America. But I'll sing a song for Basra.